This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and it's time for Pressing Matters, the show that gets to the story behind the headlines. Our guest this morning is James Minchin. He's the author of No Man's an Island, an analysis of the so-called founding father of modern Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, James.
Pleasure, Sharad.
Early last month, Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong commandeered time in Singapore's parliament to address allegations by his younger siblings that he was abusing his power and exploiting the legacy of their late father, Lee Kuan Yew. It was the culmination of weeks of public wrangling by Lee Kuan Yew's children over their late father's legacy, and it also opened up questions of how central the Lee family is to the island's governing structures. It put the Lee family under an uncomfortable and unfamiliar media spotlight. James, I'd like to begin with your book, which was written like 3 decades ago now. Was there anything in your book that anticipated the events of the last couple of months?
I think, in fact, quite a lot of the nature, particularly of Lee Kuan Yew and his achieving of political power in complete consonance with his own inner character and drives and the political fortunes of Singapore, which it crystallized in his case in an almost unique capacity to drive the political agenda in Singapore in 1965 at the time of separation, when there were various groups in amongst the people and in the party which wanted to go in different directions. Some wanted to stay in Malaysia and fight it out. Others wanted to quit, and because they saw an economic future of Singapore being dragged back by Malaysia. And so Lee was alone in feeling the force of those two things. But because of his own character, he'd always been his own man, and that gave him almost unparalleled capacity to drive the political agenda.
I mean, I read your book many years ago, and it's a very good read, and I'd recommend it to anybody. But it's also kind of a psychological portrait of the man, right? And there are chapters that focus on his language, for instance. And I still remember some of the quotes that you had there of him speaking about other leaders that are just gems. I repeat them all the time. But what about him being the father? We know that he's given the title of kind of founding father of modern Singapore, but as a father, because this seems to be central to the question of how his children have responded to each other in the wake of his death, and why one child might accuse another child of, wanting to exploit their father's legacy, for instance. Was there something about him as a father, you think, in dealing with his children?
Yes, he had a bad relationship with his own father, and he himself found a father. He really treasured it in lots of ways, and he was a very devoted father and grandfather as well, but with all sorts of caveats attaching to that. The main thing, I think, is that he realized quite early on the problem of dynastic politics. He was certainly completely different from his own father. And he was wary of handing on political power to his son. And it was really partly because he was encouraged by his minions to bring Hsien Loong forward, because Hsien Loong, in a sense, by his training, was the ideal Singaporean. Mathematics, nuclear physics, public administration, and his academic qualifications, fluent not only in Mandarin and Russian and English, but also in Jawi script Malay, which is quite remarkable.
You know, there's always the question of mothers. And if, in some ways, the elder Lee's father was a marginal character, it's always said that Lee Kuan Yew's mother was very central. And she's, of course, famous for her cookbook.
Yeah, right? And your cooking.
So the question is, also for Lee himself and his wife, who was obviously somebody he was devoted to, her role in managing the children, what insights do you have on that?
I think her role was absolutely critical. And in fact, part of the situation that emerged was that she also was wary about Hsien Loong coming to power, because politically and historically, the roles of dynasties often degenerates very quickly from one generation to another. And secondly, because from a personal point of view, she knew how overwhelming the example and the influence and the energy of Lee Kuan Yew was on his son. And his son has nothing of that same kind of central confidence in himself, that which I described in the book. And the interesting thing about my book, if there is anything interesting about it, is that I was determined not to put the analytical stuff up front, because I think the historical reading of the man and his life brings you almost inevitably to certain conclusions about himself. And I just use the word masterful, which is not really a fraught psychological word, but he is determined to be dominant. And his dominance over the Singapore government and the people of Singapore is impossible for Shen Long to reproduce. And in fact, in many respects, I think in the latter years, Shen Long found the influence, presence of his father quite difficult to cope with. And his mother, until her death, or till she became very ill, his mother was an incredibly good moderating influence between father and son.
Now, you use the word dynastic, which is quite interesting because it skirts that other fraught word, which is nepotism, right? And nepotism, because it's the charge and something that the Singapore government has always sort of nailed by taking anybody who's ever uttered that suggestion to court. But there is a problem, and because that is, as the children rose, they came to prominence, they won present scholarships given by the state. Shen Long has an astounding rise to power within the Singapore Armed Forces. He joins in 71. He leaves it and he becomes, in 1983, the youngest Brigadier General in Singapore's history. Now, the only way to explain that away is to say this was pure merit, right? And that would be true, again, of his other son, Lee Hsien-Yang, who also becomes a Brigadier General by the end of his career in the Singapore Armed Forces. Do you think that this was a kind of a real difficulty, I mean, in a discursive sense, for the Singapore state? How do you deal with these, they're the best person for it, when it'd be very hard to turn down the son of Lee Kuan Yew for either a scholarship or for a promotion?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of merit. There's no doubt the three children, Shen Yang and Shen Long and Wei Ling, are extremely able, and they were trained to be, they were put under pressure to be. And Shen Yang always was the most relaxed of the three and determined to avoid going into a career path that was simply determined by the minions of Lee Kuan Yew saying, oh, dear Mr. Lee, you really must appoint your son and the army is inevitably going to appoint Shen Long and Shen Yang as Brigadier Generals. It's a question of merit, but also the whole structure of the Singapore Armed Forces, which changed so dramatically under Goh Keng Swee's influence after the separation. It almost required people with those kind of qualifications, a strong academic qualification, strong sense of civic capacity to go. And so one can never disentangle the respective elements of merit and patronage.
Of course, just a quick note that Lee Hsien-Yang went on to become CEO of Singtel, which was by capitalization the largest listed company in Singapore. And of course, Shen Long's wife headed Temasek, which of course is the sovereign fund of Singapore. So there is this nexus, it seems. We assume that it's all about merit, but why then, if this was a perfectly planned, scenario for Lee, continues, he's safe in and assured that his children will carry on his legacy, et cetera, that it all came to this situation now of a feud between the siblings over the question of Oxley Rise, the house that Lee Kuan Yew lived in. I mean, it's almost like reading a novel. I mean, it has a kind of poetic quality about it.
Again, one needs to remember Lee himself had great qualms about his legacy and being idolized. Part of him resisted that manfully, and another part of him saw it as inevitable as a consequence of his greatness. He had no illusions of humility, and that was important. But that ambiguity is there in the family. It's been focused, I think, largely under the influence of Lee Hsien-Yang's wife, Lim Suet Fern. Her father, Chong Ya, was a well-known economist.
And, oh, Lim Chong, yeah.
Yeah.
He wrote the textbook, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. And the relationship between Chong Yao and Kuan Yew was a little problematic. But Swit Fern is a very strong person in her own right. And she, in a sense, is fueling the view that Shenlong is trying to use the apparatus of state to milk the legacy of Papa. I think there's probably some truth in that, but I think there's also truth that Kuan Yew himself, in his conversation with Shenlong, if we can believe what the Prime Minister has said, had some reservations about trying to exclude all kinds of protecting of the legacy. And it's seen generally within circles that know him that Swit Fern and Shen Yang and Wei Ling are on one side, and Shenlong and Ho Qing on the other side in this debate. And so there's some allegations that Hong Yi, Shenlong and Ho Qing's son, has political ambitions, and this is preparing the way. If Shenlong doesn't need to cash in on the legacy because he's already there, and I think increasingly finding the burden of office very hard to take, and you're looking to the future, this might be, but it's a supposition. We don't know definitely.
And it's been denied, hasn't it?
Yeah, Hong Yi is denied. But I mean, you know, everyone denies these things.
Until they stop denying it.
But I find the whole dynamic of this controversy is quite human and quite comprehensible. I don't find it disturbing. But what it does show is how, with the death of Li Kuan Yew, any pretense that political power can descend dynastically or by any other controllable means is quite false.
You're listening to James Minchin, author of No Man's an Island, an analysis of the late Li Kuan Yew. This is Pressing Matters. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Pressing Matters. I'm Sharad Kutin, and our guest this morning is James Minchin, author of the 1986 book No Man is an Island, an analysis of the late Li Kuan Yew, Singapore's first prime minister. I want to mention a book that's come out, came out a couple of years ago, 2013, by Flinders University lecturer Michael Barr, author of the book The Ruling Elite of Singapore, Networks of Power and Influence. And the blurb on the book suggests that there is a contemporary network of power in Singapore that is in fact a deliberate project initiated and managed by Li Kuan Yew, designed to empower himself and his family. Now, this is just the blurb, so I might be mischaracterizing what could be quite a nuanced argument. But do you think this is the idea of a ruling elite against the idealized notion of meritocracy, that only the best people come into Singapore government or rise in Singapore corporations or do well in Singapore schools? The idea of an elite entrenched with vested interests that they protect and want to reproduce over generations. Now, is that something you'd be persuaded by, the idea that there is, in fact, a ruling elite?
There is, but it's not a monolithic structure. There's no doubt at all that meritocracy was applied at different stages. It's been applied very selectively, of course, with the old man still in control. But meritocracy of itself is only a one or two generation phenomenon, because those who've earned merit in one generation, by two generations later, they want to hold on to it, and they therefore block any new merit coming forward. It's just one of the psychological realities of society. People who gain power and have very substantial power, whether it's hidden behind the scenes or up front, want to hold on to it.
We've seen, of course, dynastic politics play out in other countries. We think of Nehru, mm-hmm. his daughter Indira mm-hmm. Gandhi, and of course, then her sons mm-hmm. taking over. We had Sanjay Gandhi, who died tragically, and then of course Rahul Gandhi, who also was then assassinated, and now Rahul's children are coming to the fore, and of course they're leading a Congress party that seems to be bereft of any ideas except for the family, the idea that the Nehru clan must continue to lead the party. Your thoughts on the question of, you know, dynastic politics and leadership, and especially this part of the world?
I think that dynastic politics in today's world is almost impossible. And what we've seen play out in India, say, becomes grotesque. And I think Shenlong is one of the problems. I don't know the man personally, so I'm venturing to speculate. I think he finds the burden of office quite difficult and has done for a number of years, and he's had terrible health scares a couple of times. So he would have no glib notion of handing on power. It's very dangerous to do.
In the U.S., we had Ivanka Trump, daughter of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump's son-in-law, key players in the administration. And that's also sort of unusual in an American scenario. I think one thinks of the Kennedys, perhaps, where the two brothers were. One was the Attorney General, I believe, was it?
Robert,
while his brother was president. But there is that impulse, you say, as you noted earlier, you know, of wanting to kind of having achieved privilege to maintain that privilege. Where do you think it goes? I mean, where do you think countries that have this move on to?
I think for Singapore, the likelihood of dynastic politics is very low, because even if, say, Hong Yi, or probably one of the best public speakers in Singapore, who is very close to Lee Kuan Yew, his grandfather, is Lee Sheng Wu, the son of Shen Yang and Swet Phun, and he's been quite vocal in buying into this debate on the side of his parents.
Oh, he's now the subject of a suit, right? He's the one who says he will not return home to face the suit, but he'll have some sort of legal representation.
Yeah, he used a subtle distinction between the word pliant and compliant, which I thought was fascinating. But, you know, on the face of it, The trouble with politics is manifold in the world today, but on the one hand you have those who rise to power on the basis of a real desire to exercise control and authority, and then when they get into power, very often their administration is hopeless. And Lee Kuan Yew always believed that just gaining power was never enough. You had to consolidate power and make the whole society resonate to your music. And there's no one who can effectively do that. The most logical prime minister to succeed Shen Lung is Tharman Shanmugaratnam, but I think it's most unlikely either that he would want the office or that he would be allowed to attain it.
You know, you, of course, as a Singapore observer, kind of long in the tooth, if I can use that expression.
Yes, you can.
You know, the question of whether Singapore, extraordinarily affluent, with also a very capable bureaucracy, we're told, with a highly educated population. The prospects for democracy there, I mean, true democracy, with the PAP perhaps one day losing power or there being real competitive politics there, do you think that is a likely scenario for Singapore?
There are two things to say there. The first is, if I were wanting to enter into politics, well, albeit on such a small scale as Singapore, I think there is no government in the world that I would rather head than in Singapore, because the Singapore government is ubiquitous. It's involved in so much of the life in so many other countries. Democracy, outward democracy or populism, has surrendered to the force of military or lobby groups and lobby interests, often working together to administer the state. And of course they're administering the state not in the for the sake of the people at large, but for the sake of their interest. The only country in the region that's remotely and very messily democratic in that sense is Indonesia, and goodness knows what's going to happen there, especially if Prabowo comes to office as president after Jokowi. But Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Myanmar, dare I say Malaysia, there are many, many problems where money politics and lobby group politics and racial politics and so many other factors muddy each other's waters. And Singapore has the capacity with this, but it must have a strong leader. And there's no one, in my view, that's showing up in that capacity. So that, this is a great dilemma. But for governments nowadays forsaking public responsibility, handing it over to private corporations or semi-government bodies, to me is just abrogating responsibility.
We come back to the story of the feuding leads. There's talk that, in fact, some reports came out suggesting that the feud might be over, that at least or less visible to the public. But do you think that's a likely scenario, considering that so much has been made of, in the past, of dissidents using arguments about the abuse of power, of the heavy hand of the machinery of state being wielded by those in the PAP to keep in power and such? Can they let those accusations go? Do you think this is going to end badly for the Lee family?
I don't think so. But I don't think it's going to end with any guarantee of a future for the Lee family. I think there'll be some accommodation. I repeat, the old man himself was ambiguous about this. He didn't want dynastic idolatry going on of him. On the other hand, he quite liked the fact of recognition of the reality of what he'd made of Singapore. It irritates me beyond speech to think of the idea that one man has built the nation. When you think of all the hardworking Singaporeans, all the guest workers that have come in to make Singapore possible, it was under the direction of this man who had some very mainstream ideas, but also some very unusual and eccentric ideas. But he's had this unparalleled option to exercise power. He's dead, and no one else can take his place directly unless some strong leader emerges from somewhere who has the capacity to hold together the administration of the state with the exercise of that kind of popular influence which Lee commanded. Shenlong doesn't have it, and I think would gladly give it up. I mean, that's pure speculation on my part. I don't see that being possible to be repeated. But on the other hand, there's no clear sign that the PAP has the capacity to renew itself. There's no clear sign that there's anyone else in the wings of whatever race who could come in and take over.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Our guest this morning is James Minchin, author of the 1986 book No Man is an Island, an analysis of the late Lee Kuan Yew, giving us an insight into the much publicized and perhaps all too public feud between the children of Singapore's first Prime Minister, Lee Kuan Yew. I'm Sharad Kutan on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.